Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
I've been agonizing over this little short passage of Scripture this week because of some things here that I had to rethink a little bit through of my theology. I wish I had mine all together, you know. I could just come and present it in outline form and it'd be through. But I'm afraid mine's still growing and I have to change part of what I believe as the Bible continues to be open to me. And a while back, as we talked about demon possession, I told you that I believed in that and that I was very against shows like The Exorcist because they portrayed demons in little children, you know, and I said you had to cooperate with the demonic to be possessed. But I want to tell you, we've got a little girl here, and the word used means she's under 12, and it's a similar example to the boy that's in Mark chapter 9. And so we're going to have to rethink maybe through a little of this and exactly what we believe biblically about this kind of thing. But let's, Vernon read to you a parallel passage from Matthew. And Matthew is unique in several ways. Now let's think about how Matthew would be unique. One reason why an introduction to the Bible like Paul's been teaching on Sunday night is so important is you get to learn things about biblical books you never knew before in the sense of setting. For example, Gospel of Matthew is written for Jewish people. And therefore, this lady saying to Jesus, son of David, is very significant in the book of Matthew. Now, she doesn't say that in Mark. Mark is written to who? Gentile population, you see. In Matthew, she's called a Canaanite woman. Now, that's very important for Jews because they just didn't like them a bit. In Mark, written to Gentiles, she's simply called a Syrophoenician woman of the Greek faith. So, Matthew is a dialogue. Jesus said this, the woman said that. Jesus said this, the woman said that. Mark has the earmarks of a second-hand story. Now, we all, I think, at least I accept the fact that Mark is the recorder for Peter. And so Mark is retelling the story as Peter remembers it, and he's not making it direct dialogue as Matthew was, because Matthew was there. And this seems to add a backdrop to this setting of why Mark and Matthew seem to deviate a little bit in this story, not very much, minor. They put it in a different setting, but the Gospels do that a lot. And so I'm going to go ahead and reread Mark for you because of the difference, okay? And I'm going to read 24 down through 30, okay? Remember, I'm reading the Williams translation, so follow me in yours, please. Then he left there and went into the neighborhood of Tyre and Sidon and went into a house and wanted no one to know that he was there. But he could not escape public notice. On the contrary, a woman whose little daughter had a foul spirit at once heard about him and came and flung herself at his feet. And she was a heathen and spoke Greek and had been born in Syrophoenicia. And she kept begging him to drive the demon out of her daughter. But he was saying to her, "Let the children first eat all they want, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it out to the house dogs." But she answered him, "Yes, mine has Lord," but it should be sir. She's not calling him Lord. "Yes, sir. And yet the house dogs under the table usually eat the crumbs the children drop." Then he said to her, "Because you have said this, go home. The demon has gone out of your daughter." And she went home and found her daughter lying in bed, and the demon was gone. Now let's set some background for this. I think it's helpful. This story is very reminiscent of one of the major prophets in the Old Testament. Who had an incident like this in his life? Who? Remember? Elijah. 1 Kings 17, verses 8 and following. Very certain. Matter of fact, the town that Elijah helped the widow of Zarephath in, Zarephath, it's just a few miles south of Sidon. So Elijah helped a widow who was out of Israel. Matter of fact, in Luke chapter 4, verses 25 and 26, Jesus mentions this account about the the helping of this widow who was not a Jew, and the healing of Naaman who was a Syrian, to tell the Jews that his mission was wider than the house of Israel, and the Jews got infuriated. So the context here is almost like he is reenacting Elijah's ministry to people outside of Israel to show that the message that Jesus brought is a wider message, although it's restricted historically first to the children of Israel. That's why the Bible many times, especially Paul, says to the Jew first and also the Greek. It's a very popular phrase in Paul's writings. Now, I want you to also know the context. Now, as I go through Mark, from time to time, I try to help you to understand how to interpret the Bible for yourself. For most people, really just think you can pull words out and verses out and doesn't make any difference, but the context is very important. Where it was written and the setting it's written to. Now, this little story is placed in the middle or right after the discussion of what? Unclean and clean foods. What would be the connection between this story and unclean and clean foods? It'd be the very same connection as between Peter on the rooftop when the sheet was let down with all the animals in it, and the purpose of that vision was that all men are clean, and the servants of Cornelius were on their way to talk to Peter. And I think it's very significant that Mark put the discussion of unclean and clean foods and then followed it by Jesus ministering to a Greek Syrophoenician woman. I think it's extremely important to that. Now, Tyre and Sidon, this is the coast of the Mediterranean Sea, Dead Sea's here, Jordan River, Sea of Galilee. Tyre and Sidon was in the land of the Phoenicians. It'd be northwest of the Sea of Galilee, okay? Now, Jesus is going into a predominantly Gentile area. There's a problem with the Greek word here about whether it means he went into the region of or went to the borders of. Because of the use of the Greek preposition here, I think he went into this Greek country because, you see, he wanted to get away. He needed to get away with his disciples, and he was being mobbed around the Sea of Galilee, and so he went to a predominantly Gentile area to hopefully get away for a chance to be with the disciples, to explain them about his coming death. He did the same thing when he went to Caesarea Philippi to get away for a while with Peter's great confession. So he's in a predominantly Gentile area, I believe. But of course, he couldn't keep himself secluded. For we see in verse 24 here it says, but he could not escape public notice. Now, the reason he couldn't is, back over in Mark chapter 3, verse 8, one of the places mentioned in Mark 3, 8 is this region of Tyre and Sidon. So people had known about him from way before, and the rumor had spread. See, this crowd came from Idumea, Jordan, neighborhood of Tyre and Sidon. So these folks had heard about him. They knew about him. And even though it was a predominantly Gentile area, it must have been a Jewish house that Jesus went into. Because now, although Jesus continued to blast the oral law that had grown up around the Old Testament, Jesus was not the kind of man to just butt heads with people on purpose. So I'm sure he wouldn't go into a Gentile house because there had been a furor over that, as well as there was a Sabbath, and he was trying to get away from that. So this is possibly some Jewish person's house that he knew, and he went in to be with him. Now notice what it says here, that verse 25, a woman whose little daughter had a foul spirit. Number one, the use of the word little daughter implies to me that she's not a woman yet. A Jewish girl became a woman in the eyes of the community when she was 12 years old. So this little girl is under 12. Now how under, we don't know. But it says she was demon possessed. Now over in Mark 9:17 and following, we have the same thing about a little boy. It doesn't call him a little boy, but it's a child apparently. And his father comes and talks to him, and on and on. So apparently there is a possibility of this happening in children. I was talking to Jimmy Ward in my office. I said, Jimmy, let me ask you a theological question. He loved it. And I said, I have real problems about children being involved with demons. Because I'm committed intellectually, emotionally, and every other way I know how to the Bible as the Word of God, I can't get around the fact of the reality of demon possession. But I've always believed that it had to be a cooperation on the part of the person. or at least going along with some case studies that I've read, at least some sometimes ignorant association, but nevertheless association with some of the cultic arts. Well, Jimmy was telling me about a couple of kids in Waco who were 9 and 10 who cold-bloodedly killed a man. I mean, just boom, boom kind of thing. And then he was just wounded, and he said, "Well, boy, y'all have shot me. Why don't you just go ahead and finish?" They said, "Okay, we'll." And bam, bam, shot him dead. Now, 9 and 10-year-olds, pretty young, isn't it? And I don't know that what this little girl did or could have done to have this happen to her. I've just got to admit to you that I need to rethink some of my theology about demon possession, and I'll be in the process of doing that in the days ahead, and would rather hold my understanding of this till a later time. We'll hit demons before we get a mark again. I want to do some more study on it because I found the problem in my understanding, and I need to do some further study, okay? Now, the little girl had apparently this demon, and this was a non-Jewish lady, apparently, even though she calls him Son of David in Matthew. I don't think she understood what she was saying. It's kind of like, I'm president of the Lubbock Ministers Association, but I don't know what to call these dudes. Father, brother, reverend, pastor, turkey. I don't know what to call these guys. We had Pat Baylor, are you here? Where is she? This guy from the United Way called me up. They wanted me to pray at this kickoff luncheon, and he says, "Is the Reverend Dr. Utley in?" And so I got the phone call. This guy said, "What do they call you up there?" I said, "Why?" He said, "I asked your secretary," she started giggling. I said, "Well, they call me Bob most of the time." So he said, anyway, this lady was calling him something that she thought he ought to be called. It's kind of like me calling someone else an elder or a pastor teacher. They go by different names, as you know, denominations. So I think she was saying something that she heard, and she thought, I think, she ought to call him that. I don't think she had any understanding of the messianic implications that were involved there, really, because I think she is not a proselyte. It doesn't appear like. Apparently, she's just a pure pagan. Okay, now, notice that this whole exchange here in Matthew and somewhat Mark is a bit caustic, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't jive with what we think about Jesus' compassion and tenderness. He's coming across a little like sandpaper, if you please. Now, I think there is a purpose for that. I have one of two understandings in my own mind about it. Either, and you know this, that you've got to hear the inflection of the voice to know if a person's being sarcastic or if he's being if he's really sincere or if he's making some kind of joke or something. Now, I think the disciples said, "Send this woman away. She's screaming after us. She, you know, we can't help her. Will you get her out of here?" Well, see, that's recorded in Matthew. And Jesus may have said, as he looked at them out of the corner of his eye, he said, "Now, you know, lady, you're a dog," and kind of looked over at him and smiled. See, I'm going traditional. "And you know you can't eat the breads that belong to Israel." And they were going, "That's right, that's right, that's right." And what he's going to do is just axe that theology. But he may have been doing that sarcasm to the disciples. Now, I don't know how comfortable I am with that. The other thing that I really would lean more toward is Jesus always wanted a faith response on the part of other people before he healed or that kind of thing. And I think by his questioning to see if she was ready to take a submissive place in relationship to the children of Israel, he was, in a sense, testing her faith. I don't know what else it could be, really. A good interpreter that I like very much, Edersheim, who is himself Jewish and was converted, says that going back to Matthew, that she understood completely what the term Son of David was, and that she was claiming that he was the Messiah, and he was trying to clarify her understanding of the Messiah. I just don't know. It does seem a bit caustic, I have to admit, but I think if we heard his inflection, if we saw the scene, it wouldn't have this kind of appearance to us that it has on a printed page, okay? Because I think Jesus cared about this woman. And the reason this thing is so significant is, to my knowledge, this is one of the first totally non-Jewish people that he ministered to. So the gospel is breaking out of bounds, friends. He is going to, even though the lost sheep of the house of Israel priority him, he is ministering to people outside, just as Elijah did, and just with the widow of Zarephath and Naaman the Syrian. Okay. Now, notice where it says in verse 26 that she was a Greek. Now, that apparently is religious background, born in Syrophoenicia. The reason he put Syrophoenicia, there was another Phoenicia called Lydia Phoenicia, and so it's just a geographical term of clarification. Now, it says she kept begging, imperfect tense. Friends, she didn't come and say one time, "Would you heal my daughter?" This lady was coming all the time. Man, if she was the physical embodiment of keep on knocking and seeking. I mean, every time they turned around, there she was, either talking to disciples or talking to Jesus, and the disciples got put off by it. But she's continually asking. She won't give up. She keeps on. And she says here, to drive the demon out. This aorist tense, she had great faith. She said, "You drive the demon out once and for all." She believed he could do it. And she kept asking to do it. And no ambiguous terms. She said, do it completely, and do it now. How about that? Now, in verse 27, we see, and he says to her, "Let the children first eat all they want." Now, there is a difference of opinion over who the children refer to. Some think it refers to the disciples. The disciples are tired. They've been ministering now. They've come back from a mission trip. They can't get away. The multitudes are following them. They're bone weary. And some see this reference to children as the disciples. Let them rest. Let me teach them. And when I get through teaching them, if I have time for you, I'll do it. But that doesn't fit the context, does it? It doesn't. The context of the whole New Testament is that Jesus had and felt a special calling to the children of Israel, the Jewish people. And so I think the context of the whole New Testament, as well as the particular passage, lends itself to say the children are the natural seed of Israel, Abraham. Okay? I think that fits better. Now, he says to her that it's for the Jews first, plainly. And it's no right to take the children's bread and throw it to the... Now, Jews really had this loving spirit. And their affectionate term for everybody who wasn't in their group was... Dog doesn't say it. Maybe if I said cur or alley dog or other terms, you would get the idea of what the Jews thought of the Gentiles. Now, Jesus does not use that term here. He uses a term with a little ending that makes it little puppy. Williams has house dog. That's all right. But little puppy is better. So he's using the word that the Jews used in derision to the Gentiles, but he changes it. He doesn't call them cur. He doesn't call her a cur. He calls her a little puppy. And he said it's not right to take the bread from the children and get the little puppies. Now, let me. They didn't have northern tissue in the New Testament, you know, to wipe your hands off the table. Have you ever seen kids eat? Oh, my word, I got three of them. It's unbelievable what our floor looks like. Hands, you know, it's unbelievable. In the New Testament, the way you cleaned your kids' hands was you took the white bread and you wiped their hands with the white bread, and then that bread that you wiped their hands on, that's what the dogs got. And so she was willing to take that kind of used bread to eat. Okay? That's what Jesus is saying. This, the bread from the table is not good for the puppies. It's supposed to go to the children first. Now, notice where he says, and throw it out to the house dogs, okay? And she answered him, yes. Now, the word is Lord here. It's the word kurios. But, friends, I don't think it has the theological meaning of Lord like it usually does, that Jesus is the sovereign God in human flesh. This word Lord can also mean Mr., Sir, Master, Husband, anything like that. I think she's saying Sir. I think it's a polite term. She's saying, but Sir. Yet the little dogs, the puppies, under the table usually eat, and the word here is little crumbs that fall from the little children. She picked up on that little immediately, boy. And she said, yeah, the little dogs eat the little crumbs that fall from the little kids. Smart lady. Poet. And this, and Jesus was just astounded. He said to her, because you have said this. Now, I wish he hadn't said that, because it implies. if you just read it over, it says that, that Jesus is going to help her because of her wit. No. Jesus isn't saying, because you've answered so cutely, because you're so smart and intelligent, I'm going to help you. Now, that doesn't fit the character of Jesus to me. Much better fits Matthew 15:28 when he says, your faith is great. I think it's her persistent faith and her willingness to be submissive that Jesus is rewarding, and not simply her sharp wit and quick tongue. I don't think Jesus is kind of a dispenser of miracles, and if you kind of appease him or appeal to him, he'll dispense them out. I think Jesus cared about the little daughter, and I think Jesus was concerned with the lady coming to know him by faith. So even though it says, because you said this, I'm going to use Matthew and put the two together and say that Mark is not meaning what it seems for us to imply in the English language. Now, go home, the demon has gone out of your daughter. Now, friends, this lady didn't say, well, you didn't say anything magic. You better come home with me. This lady had faith you wouldn't believe. She just said, yes, sir, I'm going home right now. Jesus didn't say hocus pocus like the Greek miracle workers did. He didn't issue no cantation. He didn't give her a cloth to put in her daughter's head. He said, go home, it's done. And this lady, in the kind of faith she had, said, thank you very much. I'm going home now. Now, friend, she did have great faith, and she believed that Jesus could do. Now, whether she believed he was a great miracle worker like the Greeks had, or if she had some theological understanding, I think that he started, we don't have the whole conversation here, just a little part. I think Jesus imparted to her some knowledge about himself. And she believed it. She said, yes, sir, I'm on my way home right now. Well, she got home. By the way, the demon has gone is perfect tense in Greek. Now, what does that mean? Happens in the past, results abide. So in the context of the demon gone out of the girl, what does that imply? It's gone out and it won't come back, right? It's gone out, it remains out. This was no weekend cure. This is permanent stuff. Now, so then, verse 30. She went home and found her daughter laying on the bed, and the demon had gone. Perfect tense. It was gone. Okay? So recognize here that the faith on the part of who caused the healing? The mother's faith affected the child. Oh, mothers, daddies, listen to me just for a moment. I'm going to preach a minute. I've never understood how God uses intercessory prayer. I've never understood it. And the reason I haven't understood it is because that I know that God won't violate a person's free will. We can pray for somebody and we can be so concerned, but God won't force our prayers in someone else's life. And yet, I believe that somehow when we pray, as hard as it is for me to imagine theologically, that God puts a little extra effort. Now, the reason I have problems with that is because I think God loves people more than we love them. And how God could put more effort than his own love, I don't know. But somehow I believe that the intercessory prayers of love and faithfulness make a difference in the lives of people. And parents, don't ever stop praying for your kids. I believe with all my heart that I'm here tonight instead of on a motorcycle because of the prayers of my mother who knows Jesus. I believe that. I believe that. Hang in there, parents. Don't give up. Now, then that we leave in, he's going out of the neighborhood now. Exactly, we don't know, because you see in verse 31 we have a geographical problem. Now, Tyre is the southern city on the coast, and Sidon is the northern city. And it says, I don't know if I want to say this or not. He left the neighborhood of Tyre and went by way of Sidon through the district of 10 cities. That's like going to Oklahoma to get from Lubbock to get to Fort Worth. That's exactly the same analogy. You just don't go to Oklahoma to get to Fort Worth unless there's something wrong. I feel so comfortable that Jesus made a geographical mistake. But many folks think it's a manuscript problem, but that's a bunch of baloney. It's in the best Greek manuscripts we got. It may have been a loop that he made on purpose. I just don't know. But anyway, it's way out of the way because Sidon is north of Tyre. And if you're going south, you just don't go north, usually. You do sometimes. The district of the 10 cities is a place where the Gadarene demoniac had been sent to witness. It's a Gentile place, 10 cities there, founded by Alexander the Great, very Greek kind of setting, and Jesus was heading that way, okay? Down the Sea of Galilee, 32. And they brought him a man who was deaf, and look at your translation. He was deaf and what? What does King James have? Had an impediment. Okay, what does someone else have? New American Standard. Okay, I'm sorry. Spoke with difficulty. How about Revised Standard Version? He had an impediment. Now, you know that deaf people who usually have been deaf from childhood cannot speak at all because they haven't heard sounds. Now, some can with special training, but the majority of people who are deaf from childhood cannot speak, even with difficulty. So I think this man was not always deaf, but it was a disease or an accident somehow. Now, the word here, almost dumb, is a Greek word that's only used one time in the whole New Testament. It's used right here. It's used one time in the Old Testament in one of the most significant prophetic passages about the work of the Messiah. It's used in the Septuagint in Isaiah chapter 35, verse 6. And I want to tell you, if you'll read Isaiah 35, verses 5 and 6, you'll see that the ministry prophesied for the Messiah exactly parallels the ministry of this summary passage mentioned in the last part of Mark 7. So I think it is a special word picked out for the very special emphasis. Such a rare word, never used anywhere in the whole Bible except these two places. Isaiah 35, Mark 7. It meant he could talk, but he talked brokenly. You couldn't understand him very well. Now, and they begged him to lay hands on him, and so he took him off from the crowd. Now, why? Why did he take him off from the crowd? Two reasons. Which one is predominant, I don't know. Number one, in a minute we're going to talk about, and he said, don't tell anybody. So one reason he took him off, if he didn't want the story told, he wouldn't heal the man right in the middle of the crowd. Took him off behind the barn by himself. Said, y'all stay here, be right back. Second reason, and I don't know if this is right, but I see the possibility of it. Jesus, being the compassionate kind of person he was, and knows this man was very uncomfortable in the crowd that he couldn't hear, and everybody's making signs like, this is him, this is the guy. You know how you do charades, it's ridiculous sometimes. Took him off so he wouldn't be embarrassed so much about what was happening. Now, listen to what Jesus did. Verse 33, and so he took him off from the crowd by himself and put his fingers in his ears and touched his tongue with saliva. Some references say that he licked his fingers first. Can you just picture this guy? What's this guy doing? Now, he would say, we call it a wet willy, right, guys? But New Testament, this was done for medicinal purposes. They thought that saliva had medicinal qualities, and they used it some. And so by Jesus touching the fingers to his mouth, he was, in a charade kind of way, bringing faith out of this man who could not hear. He couldn't say, believe in me, because the guy couldn't hear him. He couldn't say, I'm the Messiah. The guy couldn't understand him. So, in a symbolic way, he licks his fingers and placed them in the man's ears, I think saying, this is going to heal you. And then he took his saliva, put it on the man's tongue. It's kind of a way of expressing this man what he was trying to do. And then the Bible says he looked up to heaven. Now, I don't think he was just super pious and decided to look up. It's a charade to show the man what he's doing. He's going to heal his hearing. He's going to heal his tongue by the power of God. He looks up and begins to pray. Now, I think he was eliciting faith on this man's part by going through all this. Jesus could have said, let it be done. Man, it be done. It's God. He can do what he wants to. But he elicits faith on the part of people. Now, Jesus does some strange things. He doesn't do things the way we would all the time. Sometimes he says, the girl's healed. Go home. Other time he makes spit in mud and puts it on people's eyes. And he has to do it twice. Other times somebody just touches his garments healed. Other times he does this symbolic stuff with his finger and saliva and lays hands on them. And sometimes he doesn't. And so he doesn't do it all the same way. But I think if we were there, we would understand the context as being appropriate to the situation of which we do not know all about. Okay? Now, suddenly, he looked at the heaven and sighed, praying, and said, Ephrathah, which is Aramaic for be opened. Now, you say, well, he's talking about his ears. I think he's talking about the whole man. Friends, I think Jesus dealt with people. He didn't say, now I'm going to heal you spiritually, but go on and starve to death. Or he didn't say, I'm going to heal you physically, but don't worry about salvation. Jesus dealt with the whole man. I didn't get that from Will Roberts, the guy from the New Testament. The whole man. Jesus is concerned with the whole man. Body, spirit. He's concerned with us. That's why, friends, the Bible does not make a distinction between the social gospel and another gospel. Friends, when you're committed to Christ, you're going to help men's physical needs and you're going to help men's spiritual needs, and you can't break that up. Can't break it up. Now, so he looked up to heaven, said, be opened. I think it means the whole man. His ears were open. His tongue was untied. It was bound. It's loosed. And he began to speak distinctly. And then he charged them, verse 34, not to tell anybody. Now, why did he charge them? Well, Mark, this is a characteristic of the Gospel of Mark. It's called the Messianic Secret. Now, why exactly? I don't know. I've told you before that one reason was the Gospel was not through. The Jews had the wrong idea about the Messiah, and Jesus would not lend himself toward their perverted view. But this is not a Jew, apparently. He wouldn't have any problems with the perverted sense of the Jewish Messiahship. So why here did Jesus say, don't tell anybody? I think. I don't know if you read these stories and Reader's Digest and some of these books I see on the newsstand. National Enquirer has some of the wildest stuff I ever saw on the front page. I've never looked at the second page. Front page is wild. And I wonder sometime about it. I really think, and I think there are some places if you really wanted physical healing and you were ready to pay any price, spiritual or physical, there's some place you'd go to get healed. There is a spiritualist hospital in South America that does mental operations. I mean incisions come and all. Now, I know that sounds wild to you, but I just want to tell you, there are some people in our day, just like in Jesus' day, who could do the miraculous apart from God. I have no doubt miracles happen all over the place. But sometimes the miraculous is not the sign of God. There are people who can do things by a drawing on the powers of evil. And I think there have always been miracle workers in a sense. And there was a lot of Greek miracle workers. Do you think these Greeks were just dummies? There was one place they went to. It was a temple to the goddess of healing. And you laid in this temple at night and these great pythons crawled over you. And then you were healed. Now, friends, you know that some of these women who laid in that place had to believe pretty strongly there was a possibility of being healed, because I don't know a woman in the world that would lay down and sleep with a bunch of snakes. So there had to be some kind of reality behind that kind of a thing. I mean, somehow there had to be something happened in that place to propagate the story. So I think there's always been miracle workers. And I think Jesus was afraid of being identified with these Greek miracle workers. That's why he said, don't tell anybody. You see, he never really was out to heal the world. That's the temptation in the wilderness of the devil. He was out to preach and change the world by a volitional commitment, not by an outward sign of healing or feeding. You see? So I think he's afraid in this particular context about the connotations of Greek miracle workers. Now, and he kept on charging them. Friends, he kept on saying, don't tell anybody. And of course, the man is so grateful, what does he do? He tells everybody. The more he kept telling them don't, the more they kept spreading it. And the people were overwhelmed, and they kept saying how wonderfully he had done everything. He makes the deaf people to hear and the dumb to talk. Read Isaiah 35:5-6. That's exactly what he says about the Messiah right there.